The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back when we started doing the program in 1994, those were different times. We had a lot of authors coming through our area. In fact, Dayton, Ohio, even though it's kind of a secondary market to publishers, used to bring in, as book tour visitors, hundreds of authors every year. You'd get best-selling authors. You'd get unknown authors that had just put out their first books, and they'd come through town, and they'd have book signings, and many of them would come out to Yellow Springs for an interview. And one of them was Jan Burke. I had had her on the program before. We had a rapport. She had just written a novel 20 years ago called Flight, and she had won a very prestigious Edgar Award for a previous book. She was riding high at the time, and before I went into the archive and pulled out this interview, I looked her up just to see what she'd been up to, and she's still living in Southern California. She's very involved in a group that tries to do forensic studies on people that have disappeared and been found again, and I'm not sure exactly what that involves, but she's really into it. In fact, her book that won the Edgar was called Bones, and there was a forensic angle on that one. She hasn't published a book in 10 years. I don't know if she's retired or she's just taken some time off, but she's a fabulous writer, and we had a really good time together in studio 20 years ago talking about her novel, Flight. Here's Jan Burke on the Best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Jan Burke. Her new book is called Flight. Welcome back.
It's great to be here. Good to see you again.
Jan, last time we had you on the program was for Bones, and I understand that I am not the only person who decided that this book was magnificent. I understand that you've gotten some awards and some recognition for that book.
Well, it won the Edgar, I'm pleased to say, which that's an award that many of my heroes in mystery writing, it's for may I actually explain for people who don't know about the Edgar, it's our Oscar in crime fiction, in the U.S. anyway. And I was really flattered and pleased. And the next morning, the blank page was just as blank as it had been the night before. So, you know, you have to kind of not let these things go too much to your head. But I'm not going to say that I wasn't thrilled. I absolutely was thrilled, yeah.
Well, that was such an ominous book. the whole thing with this woman walking around out in the wilderness with this wacko. I mean, I just love that. And that's out in a paperback now?
It's just out in paperback, yes. Yes. So it's, I think Nicholas Parrish definitely ranks as one of the scarier antagonists I've created. I had one woman tell me that she put the book in the freezer at night so she'd feel safe from him.
Really?
So, yeah, he had an effect on people. a lot of reading, you know, and keeping the lights on afterwards. So I feel that if I've deprived anyone of sleep, I've done my job.
So. Now, in the new book, Flight, obviously, I don't want to give too much away about this book because it is a novel of suspense, and I'm one of those people, when I read a book review and the reviewer says basically the entire story, I get really upset. It's kind of like sitting in a movie theater and hearing the person behind you say, oh, and now this is going to happen. So I'm a little concerned about going too far, but I guess it's safe to say that you're into Bones again in a small way.
Well, there is forensic science and procedure in this book. It's different from the previous seven because it's told from the point of view of Frank Harriman, who is, by this time, Irene's husband. in the series. I didn't plan on having them get together romantically at first. Actually, I have to say, he was just going to be what I kind of call the file drawer character, you know, just this police character that you pull into the story, get the police information from him, and then you just shove him right back out, and the amateur sleuth goes on with the detection. But Irene never agreed to that plan, I guess I'll say. So now here I am, you know, 8 books later, he's got his own story to tell. And it was very interesting to be in his shoes versus hers and to write third person for the entire book. The others are primarily first person. Some of them are a mixture of first and third. But again, there is, I'm hoping people feel a worthy opponent, someone who has his own ideas about justice and what price he's willing to pay to pursue it. I've learned how to talk about it without giving too much away. So I understand exactly what you're saying.
Okay.
Sometimes even jacket copy. I once came home to find my husband had ripped off the back cover of a Cornell Woolrich book.
Because he didn't want to look at it?
No, he had looked at it. Oh. And realized, and in his anger when he realized that the entire plot had been given away, you know, and that he might as well have, you know, just not bothered. So he now understands, you know, not to read the cover copy on a mystery. But in Flight, what happens is the story begins 10 years ago with a man who is basically a loner in the department. His name is Philip Lefebvre, and he is assigned to a very high-profile case. And it's a case against a crime boss that the department has been after for years. And then at the end of that section of the book, he has disappeared. There's a lot of evidence. The police have been convinced for 10 years that he has absolutely demolished this case, took a big payoff, and disappeared. And they've basically thought that he was drinking margaritas on Cabo San Lucas all this time and laughing at them, while they've had to face the repercussions in the community. He's sort of a one-man ramparts division scandal. So they've hated him for 10 years. And Frank is in the San Bernardino Mountains and called over to investigate when the wreckage of the Lefebvre's small plane is found. And it goes on from there. He begins to wonder if people have had it right all these years. So
now I'm listening very carefully to how you describe that, and I'm going to try to work within those parameters. This Lefebvre guy. Mm-hmm. He never knew Frank. Frank came into the department after he disappeared.
Right.
But Lefebvre knew Frank's future wife, Irene.
Right, who's the usual protagonist of the books, Irene Kelly. They met at a time when Irene's father was terminally ill. Lefebvre was a star of the department at that time, and she was covering crime stories back then. And she was one of the few reporters he had any sort of respect or willingness to deal with. So they became friends during that time, and there are a lot of people on the department who basically hint to Frank that it might have been more than a friendship.
Uh-huh. And this is a real Southern California kind of story. You've created a community that is kind of like Seal Beach or one of these towns down there near L.A. Tell us about this community in your mind.
Well, a lot of books, mysteries, cover the mean streets of L.A. nearby. They even cover Santa Barbara to the north. But I wasn't seeing anything about the cities along the coast south of L.A. They have a very different character than the northern California coastal towns, and they aren't really just beach resorts. They're cities with beach resorts sort of fixed along to them, attached to them as well. So there's this appearance on the surface of being this bright and sunny place where everybody's hanging out in their bikinis in the sand and surfing or whatever. That is very laid back, easygoing. But you go a mile or less, a half a block sometimes, in from there, and you find all kinds of urban problems as you would anywhere else. In my mind, Las Piernas sits about the place where Long Beach is, but I've stolen hills and topography from Laguna Beach to the south, actually some features of Laguna, Newport, and some of the other cities along the south there. And I think I probably go as far north as Venice to the north. There are some of the eclectic population of Venice is tossed into Las Piernas as well. But if you were to ask me where it is on the map, it's I've put it on top of Long Beach. And Long Beach itself is sort of flat. And there's one big hill, which is no longer even part of the city. It's Signal Hill. Due to oil money and all this kind of stuff, Signal Hill incorporated itself and decided to keep the bucks to itself. But I thought it's just not very exciting if somebody wants to go up in a hill to have just one hill. So I've changed the way the landscape actually is there.
Yeah, Laguna's got those really great steep grades.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you drive your car down and just about freak out if you're from the Midwest. People park their cars like practically on end. It's amazing.
You have to curb your tires there.
Right.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back 20 years to my interview with Jan Burke for her novel Flight. And the Best of the Book Nook will continue right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your source for public service journalism and music discovery. It's the Best of the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis. We went into our archive and we went back 20 years to the year 2001 when I interviewed Jan Burke in studio. She had a novel out called Flight, and we really had a wonderful conversation that day about that story and about what it's like to write crime fiction. On the Best of the Book Nook. In case you've just tuned in, my guest is Jan Burke. Her new novel of suspense is called Flight. We're talking about it in the Book Nook. I love the rivets on the cover.
Yeah, it initially had a very different look to it. And I asked that they do something that would really set it aside from the previous books in the series, because it is not another Irene Kelly mystery. It's within the realm of the world that series is in, but I didn't want readers to be mistaken about what they were getting. It's much more procedural, much more. It's a police department story in a lot of ways. So.
And in Bones, we get a little bit of Frank. But now it's like a complete flip-flop. We get a little bit of Irene.
Mm-hmm. Well, Irene is not the kind of woman that you can say, be quiet and sit in the corner. We're going to let Frank have his story now. So she is in this book. And I wanted to allay the fears of anyone that thought I might be killing her or that I'm not interested in writing about her. It's not that at all. It's just that, well, actually, since Hocus, in my fifth book, Frank is taken hostage. And there was this choice I had to make at that time to write the book entirely in first person as I had the previous four and have Irene walking around saying, gee, I wonder where Frank is. What could be happening to him? And have the readers thinking to themselves, well, I hope nothing really bad is going on. But we don't know for sure because we're not there. So instead, it seemed better to bring the action to scenes that included him. But I wanted that set apart and not in a first-person voice. So those chapters dealing with him and also actually sometimes from the point of view of his captors, I wrote in third person. So there are varying points of view in third person in Hocus, and that was the first time I'd tried that. And I thought it worked fairly well. I got a good response from the readers on it. So when in Bones, she is in a situation where I thought there would be more suspense or tension if the reader just really wasn't sure what was going on with her but got involved in his search for her, it would be better. So there are chapters of Bones that are from his point of view as well. So it's not that I've never been in his shoes. I'd been in them during those two books. But what really was weird was to come across a scene where he was walking in and I realized, my God, she's going to be in the room. And I've never had a situation where they were both on the page at the same time and it wasn't first person, her perceptions of him. Now all of a sudden I've got to see, how does he perceive her? I had a sense of that, of course, from just dealing with them over the books. But so that was a little unusual. And then in this one as well, there are some chapters where I do, there are events that take place from her point of view. And she's third person, so that was a little odd as well. But she gets herself in trouble, you know, whether it's his book or her book. Mm-hmm. That's you know, her MO.
The book is Flight by Jan Burke. Jan, I have to admit, I didn't really read this genre until I started doing this program, but I've had a crash course over the last half dozen years, and people have come through the John Sanfords and the Michael Connellys and the Bob Crays, and I've really fallen in love with the genre. And the thing about it for me, and I'm sure this is true of most readers, you got to get hooked at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. You've got to really slam it to them at the beginning so they just can't stop. And then you've got to keep that pacing going somehow. And I love the way that you began this book. I was just hooked.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I feel the same way. And actually, there are mysteries that begin, less intensely. But the kind of mystery that I want to read is, and I much prefer as a reader, is one that really, the stakes are right from the start, they're high, and there's some reason for people to want to go anywhere near these violent individuals. There has to be something that's driven them to pursue this course of action, to put themselves in that kind of danger. If they aren't there, then why are we all, you know, making this fuss over things? So I want to have something start off with a bang, if at all possible, as a reader. So I found that what works best for me as a writer is just to write a book that I'd want to read. And either there's something, it doesn't even necessarily have to be action, but there has to be something disturbing and unsettling for me, at least at the beginning of the book. So again, one of the great things about the genre, I think, is that there is a breadth to it that a lot of people, I think, are not aware of. I think some people may have read an Agatha Christie book in high school or something, and they think that all of mystery is this puzzle piece type of work, and that's fine. I mean, Murder, She Wrote was on the air for many years with people enjoying that style of mystery, which is really an elaborate sort of logic problem and devoid of a lot of emotion, really. But I prefer the hard-boiled school. I prefer the school that where the stakes are higher and where there is danger and you feel that the protagonist is in danger. And you hope that if you were in that sort of danger, that you would do the right thing, that you would find your courage somehow and proceed. And maybe you wouldn't have to be a Superman or a genius, but you'd work it out. You'd work it out the best you could.
And this is the kind of book where things are never what they seem. And as we live our sometimes mundane existence, we trust police officers. When we see a police officer drive by, we know we're safe. We don't have to worry about that cop going bad. And yet, in the world of the fantasy of suspense genre, in this book in particular, you don't know whether these cops are good or bad. You just can't tell, and you have us guessing all the time.
Well, thanks. I hope I do. That's where some of the tension, I think, of this book comes from. Also, just that that if you have a cop who is trustworthy, that he has to operate in a framework where his life depends on being able to trust his coworkers. And if he can't trust them, then he's in an especially vulnerable kind of position. You and I on the street are in a vulnerable position if that happens, but our danger is really of a different sort. His is of a different order, I guess I should say. If he's in a job where he's expected to rely on them to back him up if he needs it, or to help him if he's, you know, in need of help. So in this book, he does find himself isolated and has to work through all of his own beliefs that he's had about the department and being a cop as well. So,
when I prepare for these interviews, I find the best thing to do is to actually read the book. And quite often I'll get voluminous press materials from the publishers, even including questions that I should ask. And I think that these are generally targeted towards people in the media who maybe don't read the book and they want to sound like they know what they're talking about. So I studiously avoid them. However, in the case of this book, Simon & Schuster and Scribner had this really slick thing that they sent me that had like a question and answer thing with you, and I tried not to look at it. I tried not to read it, and then, of course, I looked at it, and there was one thing that made me chuckle, and it was something about how you got the idea for this book because you were interested in another woman's husband. I thought that was cute.
It's the only non-adulterous interest of this level you can have. I guess an author is an incredible voyeur when it comes to one's characters. So I get to observe all kinds of things about their lives, and I certainly wouldn't want anyone spying on me in the way that I spy on them. But I had become fascinated with him as a character over time, and I just reached the point of knowing that I had to let him have his own book, and thought that I would really enjoy putting him in some of the kinds of situations that really would have been a stretch for her. I could have probably told this story as an Irene Kelly story, but I just don't think it would have anywhere near the impact that it has as an insider's tale. Again, because as an insider, he's much more vulnerable than she would have been as a reporter observing all of these things.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest today, returning to the program, is Jan Burke. Her new book is called Flight. And then she'll probably go out to the airport and try to improve the facings of her book at the airport bookstore. Just kidding.
We do whatever we can.
Well, you know, it's the whole flight metaphor. How did you come up with the title?
Well, there were several meanings to that word.
And so you hate the title. And, no, I'm just kidding.
and it just seemed to me that it would work best on all those different levels. There is flight in the sense of escape here, and of course there is the plane and Lefebvre's key flight from Las Piernas in the Cessna. He is a man who loves flying, and I think there, as you get to know him, I hope the reader anyway will understand why he's a person who would enjoy doing that, why that is a pursuit that he would take on. So all those things come together. I did have, actually, the name of the book wasn't so much a problem as Lefebvre's name. I didn't know how to pronounce Lefebvre when I started writing the book, and I had to actually go on an internet list and ask for help because I kept meeting people who would have their name tags at conventions and things, and I would say, oh, great, you know, you've got this name. How do you pronounce it? Because the first time I went to pitch the book, I pronounced it one way, my editor pronounced it another, and my agent a third. And so I thought, now I'll learn. Well, every person I met with Lefebvre as a name pronounced it differently. Sometimes it was Lefevre, sometimes it was Lefebvre, sometimes it was Lefebvre. Other times it was Lefebvre. Lefebvre, Lefebvre. I've, you know, heard them all. So I wrote and asked for help from Quebecois members of the list, and many of them wrote back. And of course, I finally got an explanation of why there were these differences. Have to do with everything from where people migrated to. If you're from Maine, you probably would pronounce this Lefebvre. If you're from a city in Quebec and your parents are educated and they are moving away from the Canadian French to a more Parisian French, it would probably be more Lefebvre. If it's, you know, slightly rural, it might be Lefebvre. So, you know, it's all these things come into play. But someone wrote to me and said, well, why not just make him Mr. Smith from Iowa? And that's that sort of inexplicable, you know, part of character development for me. I'm sorry he presented himself as I got to know him as Lefebvre. And the more I went along, the more it made sense for him to be American-born of Quebecois descent, to have lived part of his life on either side of the border. Which he is in many ways a person who is that way in other aspects of his life.
Now, when we meet him in the book, I, for one, I'm sure other readers will concur with this, we like him. He's a guy who gets to us. We like his feeling. We like his emotion. We like his solitude. And then you go and do something to him, and, you know, I know this has happened to other writers. Obviously, he's not a stock character for you, but when writers do something to one of their characters that people like, that really, like, is a wrenching thing for readers, isn't it?
It is. It's not easy as a writer either. I mean, because I feel for him, if I've made him sympathetic, it's because I've felt sympathy for him myself. I've always enjoyed reading books where the characters, whether they're on whatever side of the good or evil question they fall, had some complexity to them. The Looking Glass Man, which is the name the villain of this piece goes by before we learn his true identity, is someone who believes absolutely he's doing something right. And I would hope, anyway, that readers would see why he comes to believe that, why he is made into the man that he is. That's more interesting to me than someone who's evil, just, you know, inexplicably crazy kind of evil. Even Nicholas Parrish, as awful an individual as he was, I mean, and he really is the biggest creep I've ever written about.
I loved him.
He had a sense of humor. You know, he had a Nick Parrish, whom I hate. You
yeah,
know,
a very grisly sense of humor.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. He's, you know, singing about bones.
Well, your Looking Glass Man, as I read about him, he's so fastidious. I kept thinking of Howard Hughes.
Without the money.
Yeah, Howard Hughes. And we won't say why, but
but
as you read it, he's so compulsive.
He is.
And a perfectionist. And we all know people like this.
Once a well-ordered world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Actually, I think some of the scariest people in real life are people who see clearly how things ought to be ordered.
That is scary. Yeah. There's no gray. It's all black and white.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, and he also, I think it's also frightening to be around people who believe that the system, for whatever reason, is not working, and they have that they are going to make it right by their particular vision of it, and they will do whatever is necessary to have, you know, justice and righteousness prevail. I mean, Adolf Hitler did not think of himself as an evil person. He thought of himself as someone bringing order and right and good, the greater good. And, you know, I have an equal sort of discomfort with a person like the Looking Glass Man because he's, I think, out of that same kind of mold.
Well, I liked it because we get a good serving of the Looking Glass Man. I've read a lot of books where the evil villain who you're trying to figure out the identity of is just so briefly in there and then they're gone. And you actually give him some substance, you give him some depth and some pages.
Well, thanks. I mean, I also hate, there are two things I really hate in a book of crime fiction. One is, on page 98, the protagonist reaches into his pocket, pulls out a telegram, and presents the key piece of evidence in a 99-page book. So we have exactly, you know, one paragraph to realize that the key to the whole thing is something we haven't been allowed to see at all throughout the book. That's just not playing fair with the reader. And the other is a villain who may have been, you know, sort of walking somewhere in the far distant circles of the book. And then at the end of the book, we realize that this person has been utterly absent.
The butler did it.
Right, exactly. And through all the rest of the book, it's been the butler's day off. You know?
Right.
So I don't like that kind of book either. And I actually think something that I've, you know, if I've learned as I've gone along at all, and as if I've become a little better at this, part of it is realizing that I need to bring a villain in as soon as possible, because for there to be that force for the protagonist to deal with the antagonist in whatever form, you know, whatever we do or don't know about him, you have to see him in action or her. In my books, it can easily be either one. You have to see them in action early on, those villains, so that they aren't, you know, if they're a nobody, if they're not a force, then I just don't think it's satisfying to the reader. They feel like, well, who was I, you know, who were we aiming at all this time? Someone I don't even know.
You are listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. And you can listen to Book Nook interviews whenever you want by going to our website at wyso.org and clicking on the Book Nook pages. We have over 600 interviews archived. You can listen anytime. Now this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and back in 2001, Jan Burke came out to see us here in Yellow Springs, and we talked about her novel, Flight. And we bring you that interview again on the Best of the Book Nook.
Was it enjoyable for you to somehow get out of the Irene mode and do something different? Did that sort of revivify you as a writer?
I certainly enjoyed it. I enjoy writing about Irene, so I haven't reached a point of being bored with her. But I will also say that after writing Bones, I realized that if the next book were about her, I was going to face some particular difficulties. If I were writing the kind of series where the protagonist is not at all affected by events and is the same person book to book, and that's, you know, again, in that breadth of the genre, that's a revered standard. You know, there are quite a few protagonists that really aren't bothered at all by whatever occurs. Irene is affected by the events of any book. And so to take her from a set of experiences as intense as the ones in Bones and have her ready to charge out against an equally strong antagonist would have been asking a lot of both of us, I think. And so it seemed like a good time to try something that I'd been thinking about for a long time and take some of the heat off of her in some ways and put it on Frank and let him be the person who had to struggle in this book against the antagonist. And so that was a part, definitely, of my wanting to do this book at this time. The other thing is just I experiment as I go along anyway. I have to say, if any of you are my readers, I'm very grateful to you for bearing with this because, some writers, I think, find something they're comfortable with. They feel their readers like that, and they serve that to them again in some other guise. For the next book. And I think we all can easily, quickly name in our own minds authors who do basically the same thing book after book, and we may very much like that. I'm not, putting that down.
That's... S is for successful? I'm just kidding.
Actually, I think Sue takes some chances.
Yeah, I think she does too. I love her stuff.
Yeah, but so that's what's important to me as a writer. For me not to be hating this series at this point, and I think I would if I were still rewriting Goodnight Irene. Instead, I've got someone who has been affected by what's gone on. I've got some characters that have had changes, and I feel that the books differ from one another. Not so much that they're unrecognizable, and she doesn't change so much that you're saying this isn't even the same character.
Yeah.
But, ideally that's seen as growth and not just as my being a dilettante.
Well, they're very different books. Bones scared me shirtless, and Flight is a totally different feeling, a totally different vibe, very suspenseful, but it didn't personally scare me. It was a different feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Bones, you just have this sense of total exposure to evil. You're out there in the middle of nowhere. No one can help you. If they can help you, they're dead.
Well, this, when I used to talk about Bones, I would get to a certain point and I would say, and then bad things happen.
Yes, very bad things. Yeah. Jan Burke has joined us. Her new book is called Flight. Jan, what's the process for you? How do you write? Are you an early morning person? Do you drink tons of coffee? Do you do it every day? What's the scene with that?
I'm not an early riser. That we can rule out just from the word go. I'm a night owl. and sometimes I have to say writing these books at night is not a good idea. But I really have always, any time, even as a child, one of my earliest memories of my father is of him trying to get me to go to sleep at night. I just have always, my natural cycles, I think, have just always been late night. Any time I had vacation or was able to go on my own schedule without the demand of, as one writer once put it, the most appropriately named device in America, the alarm clock going off. I write in the evenings, usually late afternoons and evenings. I write every day when I can. I don't feel obligated to write every day. I write every day because I want to, usually. Sometimes, certainly, there are deadlines, and I have to face the fact that whether I particularly feel like it or not, I'm going to have to go in there. But I'll explain it this way. I've got a little ceramic bowl that was made in the 1920s that I cherish, and it has inscribed on it, don't make toil out of pleasure.
Oh.
And I try to do everything I can not to make this drudgery. I try to stay interested in what I'm doing and my characters, in the world they're in the research that goes behind it. And for me, most of the time, the book starts somewhere in the research. Often while I'm researching one, the idea for another comes to me and something will strike me. And I'll take all of those little things that strike me along the way, and then I'll try to sort out which ones would sustain a novel, what underlying idea would sustain a novel, and work from there. I have a very understanding editor at Simon & Schuster. Mary Sue Rucci is great. She will sit down to lunch, and I'll pitch three of those ideas that fascinate me the most, and we'll talk through, and she'll we'll sort out which one has the greatest appeal and which one seems right at this point. And I have to explain that at Bones, you know, another editor had started that book with me, and so the first time she went through this whole process with me of choosing what the next book would be about, or when we were, what is basically the beginning of the contract negotiation for us, mm-hmm. Said, and the next book is going to be from Frank Harriman's point of view. This is why I want to do that. I think an awful lot of people would have said, you know, really, this series is building, and you know, you're gaining a readership. The curve is upward. Let's not do something that's going to make everybody angry at this point.
Was this before or after the Edgar?
Before.
Oh, okay. That's why.
Before. And so they were willing to go with that. Well, this year I came back at a time when I had an Edgar nomination. Not long after, I think it was nominated. I was meeting with her, and I said, and now I'd like to do something outside of the series entirely, and pitched a standalone book. Now, you know, she's got everyone in the house enthusiastic about Flight. It's not out yet. We don't know whether this is going to fly or not. and was, you know, brave enough to say, well, okay, sure, go ahead. You know, so I have to say that's one reason I love being with this house. I feel that as a writer, there's a certain respect that I'm getting that if I listen to the tales of my colleagues, not everyone is getting everywhere. But I really appreciate what I've been given there by Simon & Schuster.
Longhand or computer?
I will write, I think I'd chisel it out of rock if I had to, but mostly on a Macintosh computer. Uh-huh. I will write longhand if things aren't moving at the keyboard. Sometimes just the mechanical change will get me through a sticky spot.
You're ambidextrous. And what's next?
Well, the easiest way I can describe it, I guess, is that it's a thriller that is a cross between, it's sort of Hannibal meets the Boys from Brazil, without cannibals or clones. what happens is the homicide detective begins to suspect that a group of young men who were part of a special program for violent juvenile offenders who lived at this one boy's home are now in their 20s acting as a team of serial killers in various parts of the country. And so he has to find out what went on at the boy's home and what's suddenly sparked all of this, as well as to figure out how to anticipate where this might happen next, or where the rest of them are.
And who did you say is trying to figure this out?
A new detective.
Ooh.
Yeah, this is entirely out of the series.
So is this a new series, maybe?
Possibly. I don't know if I'm feeling that way just because I've been doing series and you get attached to characters. But so far, it's all by itself. The book after this one will be an Irene book, I think.
Uh-huh. And what's your locale again?
It'll be Southern California to start with, but it'll take place all over the country.
Okay. And the research you're doing, are you like following serial killers around? What are you doing?
No, but I've been talking to the people who hunt them. And wherever they may be, doing research again on serial killers from much more from the psychological point of view. I've been talking with people about brain chemistry and violence. And I attended the American Academy of Forensic Science meetings, spent a week in Seattle at those recently, and That's great because it's just sort of makes it so handy to connect with experts. And my usual way of doing this is to not take up their time at a time when they're trying to do their own networking and presenting, but to just ask them if I can contact them later and get leads to basic reference works so that I don't call up an expert and, you know, I sometimes joke that new mystery writers will want to call the head of the FBI for information on how an arrest is made in Los Angeles. You know, it's something that they could find out at the library.
I get those calls all the time. So these people, these forensic people, are they're steering you down the right pathology.
Oh. I'm going to try to forensic. You said that.
Well, Jan, it's really a treat to have you back.
Thanks. It's great to be here. And I have to say also to be with an interviewer who does read the books, that is why those press kits go out. And it is certainly not our standard on behalf of other authors, I can say not our standard experience. So it's really a treat to be here, and I enjoy talking with you and your listeners.
Well, the pleasure has been mutual. Jan Burke has been my guest. The book is Flight.
You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2001 interview with Jan Burke talking about her novel Flight. And I really enjoyed talking to her. And I would love to have her on the show again. I checked, and it doesn't look like she's written a book in the last 10 years, so hopefully she's working on something. And an author who is at the beginning of her writing career will be my guest tomorrow in the Book Nook at 10:30. Tomorrow morning, I'll talk to T.J. Newman about her new novel, Falling. It's a thriller, and this is quite a story. T.J. was a flight attendant, and she got an idea, flying cross-country red-eye flights from Los Angeles to New York City, and she mentioned her idea to one of the pilots on one of the planes, and when he heard what she thought, his face went pale. He was so stunned by her premise for a thriller. And TJ wrote the book. She wrote a lot of it on those overnight flights where she was a flight attendant in first class. Her passengers would be asleep, and she scribbled ideas on napkins. And when she got the story put together, she did what a lot of first-time authors do. If they want to be published by a major publisher, they need an agent. You can't just send a book to a publisher without an agent. They just don't pay any attention to it. So she sent out a dozen query letters to agents, and she got a dozen rejections. She tried it again. She sent out another dozen query letters to agents and got 12 more rejections. But she didn't give up. She sent out another dozen query letters and got another dozen. Sorry, we're not interested in this story. And so she sent out 5 more. Once again, failure, rejection, 41 rejections, but she never gave up. She sent out number 42 to an agent in Southern California, a guy named Shane Salerno at the Story Factory, and he liked it, and he tried to call her to tell her that, and she saw this weird phone number on her phone. She didn't recognize it, so she didn't answer the phone, and then he called her back, and she saw and she thought, huh, wonder who this is calling me. This is the same number that called me the other day. I better answer this phone. And it was Shane Salerno saying, I love your story. I want to represent you. He got her a book deal. He got her a movie deal. The book is going to be the hottest books of this summer. It just came out on Tuesday. The pre-orders on this book were so strong before the date of publication, that last Tuesday, when the book officially was released, it had already gone into a third printing. She's been all over the place. You might have seen her on CBS last week. She was just on Fresh Air. She's getting reviewed all over the place. The book is selling like crazy. And man, it's a gripping thriller by T.J. Newman. It's called Falling. Imagine a pilot just getting ready to take off from Los Angeles to fly to New York City. He gets the plane in the air, and then he hears from his wife down on the ground, and she's been kidnapped, and she's being held hostage. And the terrorist who has kidnapped the pilot's family, says, okay, I'm going to give you a choice. You need to decide. You need to crash the plane that you're flying, or I will kill your family if you refuse to do that. So you can choose. Crash the plane, or I kill your family. That's tomorrow morning at 10:30, right here in the Book Nook. I'll be talking to T.J. Newman, her novel Falling, one of the hottest books in the country this summer.